Hello, 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 and welcome to Tease Me. This is a podcast about the intersection of golf, business, and life. And occasionally we'll drop some gems on networking and just how that makes your life better. Because knowing more than one person is actually a good thing. Welcome to season 3 of Tease Me. During the season, we focused on the entrepreneurs, and we will continue to do so. It happens to be June, Juneteenth, Father's Day, and all of the amazing things that we think about celebrating. But the focus of entrepreneurship is really thinking about the independent journey that individuals take to build a legacy, a lasting legacy. So as you think about the skills that you've picked up over the years, pass it on to another generation. Even if you don't have children of your own, you have nieces, nephews that need your fatherly advice. So please be sure to share it. You didn't spend all these years on this earth for nothing, right? In Harlem, the Juneteenth activities have really picked up. For all of the years that I've lived here, I don't think I've seen as many corporate dollars being thrown into a community as I do now, and I'm enjoying it. I happened to be at an event where Dougie Fresh was emceeing, and I said, you know, your chicken and waffles place was ahead of its time. And he said, you know what I learned? Should have owned the building. So for those that are listening, it's about owning the property as well as the business. So let's introduce our guest. Frank T. Fraley's journey into the world of jewels, gems, and fine gemstones began more than 30 years ago as an apprentice. He was a student of FIT, which is the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. And during the years that followed, Frank has created one-of-a-kind works of art for clientele that includes Kedar Massenburg, a music producer, Brian McKnight, Philip Bailey, numerous actors, entertainers, artists, and executives. You'll hear his story on today's podcast, but in addition to his exclusive jewelry collections, he also serves as an adjunct professor at the Fashion Institute of Technology. He's also a professor of jewelry in the international program at the prestigious Altos de Chavon Art School in La Romana, Dominican Republic. So let's introduce you to our guest, Frank Fraley. Okay. Hello, 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 Tease Me listeners. We have Frank Fraley here. And Frank has an amazing story. I mean, he's lived like 3 lives, but in our series, the season, we're focused on entrepreneurs. And he's really taken the jewelry design business by storm. And I don't think you ever paid attention to where you bought your jewelry or where it came from before. Now you will. So Frank, tell us how, everyone's heard the bio, but tell us what inspired you to step into this industry.
Well, it goes as far back as the 70s, believe it or not. So I'm really telling my age now. But in 1979, I was allowed to join an internship program in my senior year of high school. And the coordinator asked me what I wanted to be, what industry I wanted to go into. And I said I wanted to be a jeweler. I guess we need to know where that came from. It's somewhere in my DNA. It's somewhere in my ancestry. Somewhere in West Africa, my ancestors were jewelers. I just know that and I feel that. And so I told that to this coordinator. And she had no idea. She admitted to me she had no idea what to do with me. And through a series of processes on her end, I ended up at FIT as a high school student on an internship program in the jewelry design department. And I had a wonderful Jewish godfather who was the chairman of the department. I affectionately call him my godfather. He was actually one of the professors there. And he took me under his wing. And he showed me around New York City. He made me to understand what 47th Street was all about, what the gem industry was all about, what the diamond industry was all about, and what the jewelry industry was all about, and how those three things come together under manufacture. And I've been a jewelry manufacturer and a jewelry designer ever since 1980 when I became a student at FIT.
Wow, so we have to take a few steps back. The very first step back is acknowledging that the skill and this talent is in your blood. Yeah. And being able to say that you've been called to do it and something's pulling you, no matter what you tell yourself, it keeps pulling you to that space.
Yeah.
you know, as entrepreneurs, we're often challenged with the why would you do that? And what is it about it? And why would you put yourself in all of that, you know, difficult pain, strife, whatever? Tell us more about following your gut and just your journey when it comes to stepping into the entrepreneurial space around jewelry.
Well, LaToya, you are 100% right. It is pain and strife for a young African-American brother from Bed-Stuy to have the audacity to want to be around all these diamonds, to have the audacity to want to be in a jewelry manufacturing company or in a jewelry industry where everybody trusts one another to a certain degree. I can go out today and pick up five diamonds worth about $15,000 or $18,000 each to take to a client, and I do that with a signature. How in the world does a kid from Bed-Stuy have that much power in a signature? Well, that's what the industry demands. I didn't think it made sense either, because I wasn't the son or a grandson of a jewelry Jewish tycoon. That's how most of my counterparts came into the industry. They came in through family members. And I didn't have any of that. But as you said, there's something inside of each of us that leads us to various different directions, professionally, entrepreneurially, emotionally. I mean, I'm a Baptist preacher. I didn't ask God to make me a preacher. God just said, boy, go preach. And so that's what I do. I follow where I'm led. And the jewelry industry was just one of those things. I was at a meeting yesterday with Tiffany and Company. I'm going to be the instructor for new Tiffany employees. How does any of that happen? You know? So when I spoke to one of the managers, the people who are going to recruit the folks in for me to teach at FIT, I said to him, I lay down at night and I make my best work because I dream about some of this stuff. And then I wake up the next morning and I come and I sit at my bench and I make it.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's so many love. I mean, I don't think that, well, I think we have to do some education first. What is a gemologist?
Gemologist generally is a person that deals in gemstones, diamonds, rubies, sapphires, emeralds, to name the most precious of our stones. But the gemologist has to be able to understand all stones. So they put them through a series of tests to determine quality, carat, the size, and the origin, right? The actual origin of the stone. Because a garnet, which is a reddish burgundy stone, could look a lot like a ruby to a person who doesn't really understand it. So the gemologist says, no, that's a ruby and that's a garnet. That stone's worth $12.50. That stone's worth $12,000. That's who the gemologist is. The diamond grader or the diamond analyst is a person who pretty much deals in diamonds, period. Do they know about gemstones? Can they look at them and sometimes determine the quality? Sure, sometimes. But the diamond grader or the diamond dealer is a person who pretty much deals in diamonds 24/7 of all shapes and sizes all the way up and down the line. And so, then jeweler or the jewelry designer kind of brings all that together.
Wait, so I'm fascinated about a few things. As you think about your pathway as a child, as a student of the jewelry industry, where do you think, if we were talking to young adults right now, would it be the creative young adults? Would it be the more scientifically driven, the more mathematical, the more artistic? Like, where does the skill set lie for someone, not to put anyone in a box, but where does the skill set lie for someone that is curious or potentially powerful in this space?
I think the greatest opportunity lies in that curiosity that you just mentioned. I could take a person, and I have, because I teach beginners all the time. And some of the folks coming in to work for Tiffany's have never sat at a bench before, but they're curious enough. the desire is there. They're driven enough for me to take that desire to want to be in this industry. And I'd love to do this with African-American kids. And I bring them to school as often as I possibly can, from middle schools, from high schools, from elementary schools. If the desire is there, I could sit the person at the bench and show them how to use the torch, or show them how to use a saw, or show them how to use the file. Three fundamental skills that I start everybody off with, that we all started with. But it doesn't require that you have a great science background, but there will be some science. It doesn't require that you have a great mathematic background. And I'm going to tell you, I did not. But it does require some math. You have to use rulers, and you have to add things up, and you have to determine what size is required here and what size is required there. So yeah, there's math, there's science, there's art, you know, and all of those things sort of come together under the heading of desire. You don't have to be an expert at anything to come into this industry. I'll tell you right now, just too many of us have decided that the retail store is where the thing magically happens, where it magically appeared. No, Zales and K's and all of these other retailers in the mall, they have lights and showcases. They buy their jewelry and then they sell it to the rest of the public. They don't make anything there.
Wow. So you said something very interesting. They buy their jewelry. They buy their jewelry from creators like yourself.
Correct.
Okay. So when you're thinking about, you know, just how do, so one of the things I think that is very challenging, people that don't know, you know, high fashion, don't necessarily know high fashion jewelry, don't know high quality jewelry. What can you educate us on what the process should be as we think about procuring our next piece of jewelry or our first piece of jewelry?
Well, it just depends on the individual. I know a lot of ladies, particularly ladies, who buy jewelry, as you said, for fashion purposes. They buy pieces to go with outfits. That's not the kind of jewelry that I make. And there's nothing wrong with that. My wife has fashion jewelry. She has fashion earrings. She has fashion necklaces. And she'll couple that with a couple of fine jewelry pieces, and she's a superstar, you know. But if you're looking for fine jewelry, it's more of a design desire and an investment desire, okay? So, yeah, I'll make a bracelet, a platinum and diamond and gold bracelet. It'll be $12,000. But you can get a costume jewelry piece that resembles what I made for $20, for $10 on Amazon, and it'll be at your house the next day. I can't compete with that.
Nor should you.
I just can't compete with that. So there's two different realms. One is fashion related, and the other is fine jewelry related. I'm a fine jeweler. That's in my DNA, as we said. I can't get away from that. So the lowest I would go would be making a piece in sterling. And then, of course, the carat goes 14 carat, 18 carat, and then platinum. But other than that, I'm not the person, you know. Do I make samples in brass and gold plate them and donate them to golf outings like yours coming up and things like that? Sure, because those things are valuable design-wise, right? They're fashion-oriented. And they have the same design quality as all of my other work. It's just that I usually make them as samples for photography and for donation purposes.
Yeah. So. And they showcase the brand. You know, it makes me think of fine art as well. You can get a picture from IKEA that looks like it was made somewhere, or you can actually go to an artist and procure a piece that they've custom curated or made.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. Fine art is very similar to what we're discussing, because you're right. You can get a pretty picture for a wall and it'll make your apartment look great. Or you can invest in a piece of art that you'll probably hand down to one of your junior relatives over time, you know.
Yeah,
you're right on target with that.
So let's go into your FIT story. So for those that are not from New York, Fashion Institute of Technology. That's it, right? Yeah, that is it.
Well, all of the United States, and we have an FIT in India. We have a FIT in Milan. We have affiliations with other schools around the world. FIT has its roots in New York City, in the Garment District, 27th Street and 7th Avenue. But it has tentacles throughout the world. Fortunately for us, the industry, the jewelry industry, the fashion industry, didn't have enough of the junior relatives of those families going into the business, right? People in the Garment District were very much into fashion and selling clothes. People in the Garment District and in the jewelry industry in the United States, or in New York, I should say, were very much into creating pieces and selling them to New Yorkers and throughout the country many, many years ago. But their children became lawyers and doctors. They weren't training their kids to go into these industries as they had done back in Europe. So a lot of them got together and put a lot of money together to create a school like FIT so that we could have generational feeders into some of these industries. So that's how FIT's jewelry department in particular came to be. Jewelers in New York said, our kids aren't going to be doing this, but our companies need to survive. It's no different than the conversation I had with Tiffany and Company yesterday. They are bringing apprentices to me to train to go into Tiffany and Company to one day replace the people who are sitting at the bench today.
Wow.
That's how FIT came to be, and that's how this other situation is happening just as recently as yesterday. So it's a great story, but it's also very necessary for industries to survive. Yeah. No different for African Americans in America. We have to train our children, right? Because they're one day going to replace us and have their own children and their own families. If they don't receive the proper education, if they don't receive the proper support, if they don't receive the proper direction, they're not going to be able to do that. And we see it manifested in so many families around the country who look like us. Yeah. So we have to provide for the future. Fashion did it for the fashion industry. Jewelry did it for the jewelry industry. And I'm trying to do it for my family.
I love it. And you see the same struggle in construction as well. You have families that have these construction houses, and sometimes they live and die with the owner, and they don't get passed on because the next generation doesn't want to work in construction. They don't want to do that heavy manual labor. They want to go to school and be doctors or lawyers or whatever the, you know, most popular Instagram influencer, I don't even know anymore what the next career path is. But talk to us more about, you know, what you didn't share is that you actually teach in Dominican Republic as well. And talk about how that journey came to be and what's happening with the gemstones in that area.
Well, much like yourself, I like to play golf all year round. And so I was invited to teach in Dominican Republic about 11 years ago now. And I was invited to teach there in January. I had traveled winters before, but the light bulb never went off like it did at that point. And I told myself, I never want to be in New York in the winter. So I find a way every winter to get it right after Christmas and get up out of here so that I could be productive someplace in the world, but prayerfully a warm place in the world. And Dominican Republic is just absolutely awesome. I stay at a place called Casa de Campo, and there's an art school there called Altos de Chavon. And in that art school, I helped to establish the only jewelry department or the only jewelry classes that they teach. So I'm invited back every January, class or no class. It was COVID, and they invited me anyway, and I jumped on a plane and I went there because I knew I could isolate myself there, and I knew I could play golf there, and I could sort of not necessarily create pieces, but I could create designs. And so it gives me a chance to, you know, you get to that special place, wherever it is in the world, where you just feel comfortable and very creative. That's my place. you know, and my family comes over and my children kind of grew up there on that little campus in winters. And then, of course, you know, we come back home in late January or early February, and you find an excursion for a weekend in Florida, another excursion in Jamaica. And I just hit something every month in the winter, and it sort of helps me get through the winter. So even when I get back here and put on my boots, I have to go out and shovel some snow and ride around in my Jeep with the potholes and all the snow mounds. That's almost fun for me, because I'm back from 80, 90 degrees, and I'm only doing this for another week or two before I'm gone someplace else. So DR is my home away from home. There's a lady over there. Her name is Martha Victoria. She's the director of my school. She probably won't see this podcast, but I love her dearly. She's like my sister, and she loves my wife. They're very close, and my kids. And there's a stone that's only found in one place in the world. It's called Larimar, and it's found in a place called Barona, Dominican Republic. It's 45 minutes from the Haitian border. It's in DR, and it's a 4-million-year-old volcano that erupted, and all of this lava went into this blue, beautiful ocean and created this blue, beautiful stone. And that's their national stone, and I love to use it, and I love to create pieces with it. And it was on display in February when you came to FIT, and I enjoyed that piece.
Yeah, so I just want to kind of go a little bit deeper. Being able to assess and define the value of something so unique, how does the industry determine the monetary value of something that is, you know, it's priceless, the manner in which it's been created? And I feel like often even our works of art that are created by African Americans, the value is determined externally from the community. I know it's supply and demand, but I'm curious to know, with these stones of such a unique origin, how does the pricing or the monetary value get determined?
By supply and demand. Diamonds are supposedly rare, therefore their value is higher. And we do have in that particular case, in the case of stones, we have a grading system that determines A, the size, B, the clarity, C, the color. So it's, you know, those things are how we determine the diamond value. But that's all subjective. That chart is created by we have a chart called the Rappaport Report. Well, Mr. Rappaport was a person, right? So it's somewhat subjective, as you're saying about the art. But over time, general accepted practices and standards become normalized. And so that's really how stones are judged. Same thing with gold. And we take a piece of gold and we scratch it on a certain type of stone, and we drop nitric acid on it. And depending on how that nitric acid eats away at the metal, we determine whether or not it's 14 carat, 18 carat, 22 carat, 24 carat. So, you know, so that's subjective too, because my eye has determined that your piece is 14 carat and your sister's piece is 18 carat, and they're exactly the same piece. Well, how does that work? Well, sometimes you're dealing with a crook.
Oh, wow.
Which is why people are so skeptical about dealing with jewelers in the first place. People constantly talk about my jeweler. You hear the phrase all the time, my jeweler. And I tell folks all the time, if your jeweler don't look like me, probably ain't your jeweler. You might just be his customer.
You know what? There are so many celebrities that are purchasing pieces and they say my jeweler, but the reality is you might just be the customer.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is a family friendly podcast, so I'm not going to use any bad words, but I know some jewelers who don't look like us, who have taken people for a whole lot of rides, and they're not your jeweler. Yeah. You're their customer. And I don't even want to say customer. I want to say something else, but I'm not.
Sucker. Yeah, they're sucker. You're their sucker.
Yeah, it's not, it's, you know, it's, you just have to be, you have to be careful who you're dealing with. And I love to educate people. I love to make sure that they know what I know. So then everything is above board.
You know, honestly, I question sometimes when I see pieces, I wonder, was it real? Did the person even care if that's real or not? Because sometimes the pieces are not necessarily designed to be quality. I mean, maybe they're quality, but they're not designed to be like collectible pieces. It's just really expensive jewelry that a person can afford, but they're going to wear it for like a month or 2 months and then move on to something else. But they're willing to pay that premium price.
That's true. That's true. And part of that is socially driven too.
Yeah. Because
once you tell your friends what you paid for something, which I don't know why you have to do that. But once you tell your friends what you paid for something, it sort of puts you on a certain level. I see some of my brothers on the NBA sideline. I'd like to get to some of them. Because they're wearing stuff that, yes, it costs a lot of money. And yes, you like it. But what campaign is that jeweler donating to? With your
Yeah.
I think about some of this stuff. You know?
Yeah, no, it's an ecosystem. It's a full life cycle.
Who are you giving your money to and who are they giving that money to?
Yeah.
You know, so I make it my business as often as I possibly can to support people like yourself, to support entrepreneurs in whatever industry. If I'm looking for something, I'm looking for somebody who looks like me who sells that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. My tailor is a Senegalese brother. My other tailor is another Senegalese brother. Okay. Now my tailors used to all be Italian. Why? Because people influenced me early on and said, you got to get an Italian tailor. They know fashion. Now, my brothers know fashion too.
Yeah.
My people know food too. Okay.
But you know what? It's about exposure and awareness. Even being exposed to the jewelry industry, being exposed to what entrepreneurship can be, what it looks like. And now when you're talking about this tailor, you also went to Africa and were exploring the jewelry. I can't even say it's just the story of jewelry. It's more like it's got its own story. And just every country and every culture has a story of jewelry embedded in it. Yeah. Whether fashion, food, and jewelry. And I don't think people think about that much. They don't.
No.
So talk to us about what led you to Africa and what that jewelry experience was.
What led me to Africa was a desire to understand who I was at my origin, who my parents came from and my foreparents and, you know, all of that. So I did my ancestry DNA. And my ancestry DNA said I was 85% African. 35% of it was Nigerian. So the bulk of it was Nigerian. So I knew it was West Africa. And that was fine. That was good information for me. But someone turned me on to something called AfricanAncestry.com. Right? And I recommend it for all of us. Because once I did my African ancestry, and it's a matri and a patria, a mother and a father. And they were, it was expensive. It was $2.99 each, as opposed to the other one, which was $49. So I did one year and one the next. And I was already planning to go to Ghana because I had friends there and there was a school there that I wanted to teach at and I wanted to connect with, and I did both. But when I came back home, I received my African ancestry DNA, which I had sent off before my trip. And it said my mother's tribe is from Cameroon and literally drilled down to the Matri clan in Cameroon. So I still got relatives in Cameroon.
How are they able to do that?
It's awesome. It is awesome. So my next trip is going to be to Cameroon, by the way. But a year later, right, because I told you it was $2.99. So it took me about a year to like, all right, I need to check out who my father is now. So I did my father's DNA, the Patry clan, another $2.99. And that came back about 3 months later, maybe 4 months later. And I'm all excited. I open up the envelope and it said my father's clan, my father's tribe is from Gabon. Now, Gabon and Cameroon are next door to each other.
Wow.
And without the international colonialist influence and the slave trading, all of that would have been part of Nigeria. So the first thing that said that I was 35% Nigerian was confirmed by the Cameroonian piece and then confirmed by the Gabon piece. My mother and father met in New York, but their tribes are neighbors in Africa.
That is insane.
It is insane. It is insane. So to lay down and to wake up every day with that kind of information makes you a different person in America. You look at things altogether different.
All right, let me get my $2.99 together.
I'm telling you, Latoya, it is so worth it. It is so worth it. I wish I could be a spokesman for them and I wouldn't get paid a dime. But what it gives you at the end of the process is a clear understanding.
Oh no, I need you to do a commercial because then you've got the jewelry, you've got the store. Yeah, they need to be compensated because, awesome. Yeah, this is a story.
It's awesome. It's all African ancestry DNA is awesome. They give you the details. And what's fascinating to me was if you're not of African origin, no need to apply. No need to send your saliva in that envelope because all they're looking for is African ancestry. That's all they do.
Wow.
It's awesome.
Wow. There's so many levels to that. I don't even know where to start, but I think one of the questions I have, knowing what you know now, and then as you did the excursion to Ghana, tell us about the jewelry story that originated and what that could potentially look like now that you know even more and you have this plan to go back.
The jewelry industry in Africa, I'll talk about it from a Ghanaian perspective because I was only in Ghana. But the jewelry industry from an African's perspective has been beat to hell. Yeah, the casting process, the mass production process, all originated in Africa. We were spinning King Tut's pieces in Egypt. Okay, so what the Europeans took was everything. The technology, the skills, the money, the resources, all of it. And as a result, you don't see quality pieces coming out. You see beads. You see brass castings. You see really the lesser pieces. And they import pieces, right? So places like South Africa. Right, where you're going to have a larger tourist and a more sophisticated jewelry customer. They're going to buy pieces from Europe, bring them to Africa, and sell them to Africans, white Africans and black Africans and tourists. So part of my desire, part of my work has been to try to work with schools in Africa to teach Africans, my brothers and sisters, how to create pieces right there in their own country. And if that means getting donations of equipment to get over there so they know how to work the newer technology, you got to do that. And if that means volunteering my time at a school and teaching young kids how to carve wax to create a piece of jewelry, I got to do that. Wow. So it's tough. It's tough. And it's disappointing when you find out some of the details of the story. But it doesn't stop me from saying, okay, we got to do better. You know, we have to teach our people what we originally taught the world, because casting, mass production of jewelry came out of Africa. You know, I can't go into the weeds with the details of it, but we carved the wax. We made the mold. We burnt out the piece. We melted metal with a flame, and now we use a gas and oxygen torch. Well, back then they used a gas and oxygen torch. The fire was in a pit and the oxygen came from the human. They blew, that's why they called it a blowtorch. We blew air into the fire to turn that yellow flame blue to make it hot enough to melt gold. That came from humans.
Wow.
You know? And it was dangerous because you had to then take this molten metal at almost 2,000 degrees and spin it around your head to move the metal from one area into another to create a piece of jewelry. That's, I mean, the technology is deep. It goes way back. Now we have all sorts of fancy machines, but guess where the fancy machines are made? They're made in Germany. They're made in France. They're made in Japan. They're made in China. They're made, you know, they're made in places around the world where the technology has been exported and the dollars can afford to increase the technology again, even higher.
That's a book, Frank, that has not been written yet. You know, there's not a history book written like that. And the honest truth is, if you think about stories that are told, they're passed from person to person. You probably got most of the information talking to someone or doing some research, but pieces here and there, but never in one comprehensive understanding, you know, of the origin and the evolution and I guess sounds like the deterioration of the growth. It stagnated when the money was gone. So
that's the somewhat depressing aspect of my search. I went to Africa to see my people make jewelry, and they have no clue.
Wow. Because
the technology and the ideas and the equipment, it's all been snatched up. So they're all, barefoot, walking around on dirt roads. They don't have money for jewelry.
Right, right.
And the stuff they make, you know, you'll go visit places like Elmina, and Cape Coast castles, you know, they call them castles, I call them dungeons, because that's where slaves were held and killed and then transported, those that survived. And the kids outside those places are almost attacking you as a tourist to try to sell you a little beaded bracelet. That's the extent of story that they understand. And, you know, I'm gonna change that as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, you also have some pieces that, you know, you've designed for the golfer. And a lot of the inspiration comes from your trip to Africa.
Yes.
So talk more about those pieces and, you know, the story of what that means and why.
Yeah, one piece in particular, and thank you for that, is called the Fulani Golf Bracelet. And the Fulani style, now sisters get the Fulani braids. It's all African. It's all West African. And then there's a Fulani clothing style that people have adopted, but it's all African fabrics. And then there is Fulani jewelry. And the Fulani jewelry, I have some here. It's a little bit of a, I don't know if you can see this, but a little bit of a twisted style bracelet.
You have to bring it closer for
to the camera?
Yeah, that's better.
How about that? Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. The people listening can't see it, so we'll have to look some images up.
And all you have to do is Google Fulani bracelet, Fulani gold, Fulani designs, and you'll see it on online. But I decided that I wanted to take this style, which was originally created in Mali, and I wanted to create it for golfers, African American golfers, any golfers who want to wear it. I'm not discriminating, but it's a small, beautiful piece that would be distinctively African. And so many of us have gotten into golf that I thought it would just be a cool thing to do. And it sort of caught on, you know? And, you know, when I'm fortunate enough to be invited to golf outings and I can bring donations, I like to bring the Fulani style because it A, educates people, and B, it hooks them up with something nice.
Yeah, well, for me, it helps me with my grip because when I see the design, I know that my hand is in the right position. So reminder,
right.
You know, I need every little reminder to help me
That's right.
Keep me focused. So wait, even your story, how did you get into golf? How did you start playing?
I started playing way back when I met you, like a long time ago. My buddy Wendell Haskins started the original tee. So that was my first big golf event that I had ever attended. But yeah, I was at a cookout at a friend's house in Long Island. These two brothers, African-American brothers, who happened to be studying medicine at the time. So they're smart dudes. One went to Morehouse, and they were just good brothers of mine. And we were at a cookout at their house, and they said, "We're going to the driving range. Do you want to come?" And I'm like, I can't drive a car. And they said, no, we don't mean that kind of driving. We mean golf balls. We're going to hit golf balls. And I'm Bed-Stuy basketball. I don't know nothing but, you know, Skelly in the street. You know what I mean? And I'm like, no, dude, I don't know what side of a golf club to even hold. And they said, nah, come on, we'll show you. So about 10 of us went out there and they got a couple of buckets of balls. And I said, well, what club do you hit? They had some woods, they had some drivers, they had some irons. And I didn't know what any of those things were at the time. And they said, well, just pick up the club you think you want to hit and then test the others. And the one you hit the best, that's the one you should hit. So I picked up a 5-iron and I hit the 5-iron. I hit a couple of good shots. I mean, I hit a couple of sloppy shots, whiffed at the ball a couple of times. But the 5-iron just turned out to be the club that I enjoyed hitting the most. You know, some days I can't hit it now, but, you know, it's a different story. But that was my first entree into just hitting a ball. And then as I met other professionals and I was invited by someone, I think I was invited by Wendell because I was at Motown. He was starting the tournament. He started with all music industry money and donations. And I was invited to the tournament. I got to the tournament, still didn't know how to play golf very well, but I was there and I knew the fashion and we were all dressing up and we were all looking good and it was all brothers and sisters hanging around. And then I saw the combination of Sylvia's collard greens, Heineken, and golf. And I said, I'm all in. This is me 100%. If I don't do nothing but come to the event and hang out with my people and eat good, I'm going to do that. So that's where I got the bug. I got the bug at OTGC.
Got it. I love it. Yes. And Wendell is doing tremendous things to continue awesome. To grow the game. So definitely love that. Yeah. And so as you've gone on this golf journey, and it seems like you've grown tremendously in it, do you have a favorite golf destination?
I don't, only because I want to see so many parts of the world.
Okay.
If my shirt will tell you that.
What does it say?
I just turned 60.
Yes. And Scotland, I see.
Next Friday, we leave.
Okay.
So there's a group of 16 guys. You know, I call them my closest friends. And they are all in on celebrating my birthday with me in Scotland. So we've got 7 days and 4 courses. And it's just going to be another great adventure. But no, I don't have a special place because I love playing in DR. I loved playing in Africa. I know I'm going to love playing in Scotland. And I know that, you know, I love playing on the Mediterranean. I played in Spain. I mean, you know, like yourself, I try to find places to go and play that also allow me to explore different cultures and environments. And you know, you're smiling because you know the thing just blows you away.
Yeah, it does.
You get a chance to do what you love in a place that you've never been before that just shows you something new about the world.
Yep.
It's the best. It really is. And, you know, I got involved with someone in the Trinidadian government recently within the last 2 or 3 years, who's now a minister in the government. But she introduced me to the prime minister when he was here, Prime Minister Keith Rowley. And Keith Rowley has a junior golf program. That junior golf program, I collected over 100 clubs from my friends. And I shipped those clubs to Trinidad. And oh my gosh, it just blows me away to see the Prime Minister of Trinidad holding golf bags and golf clubs and playing with kids in Trinidad that came out of my garage. Can't get any better than that.
No,
so as soon as it's safe to get right back into Trinidad, he's going to invite me over and I'll be playing golf in Trinidad with the Prime Minister. Who would have thought?
That's beautiful. And that's full circle moments. Like, I love those.
Full circle.
I love it. So for the people listening, well, do you have a hole-in-one or any of those amazing golf memories that you want?
I have two hole-in-ones.
You have two?
I have two hole-in-ones.
Oh, okay. Tell us where and when. Two aces.
The exact date, I have to go downstairs and look at the plaques. But I know it was right around my daughter's birthday many years ago. It was Dunwoody Golf Course, 7:40 in the morning, 7-iron, 147 yards on the 7th hole.
Wow.
That one is in my head, stuck. The other one was at Lake Isle. I used to be a member of Lake Isle years ago. I was playing with my business partner, Italian guy. His name is Anthony DeBellis. I was playing with Anthony and Anthony Jr., his son, who was playing golf for the first time. And second hole at Lake Isle, short hole, 130 some odd yards, but it has a little ridge and you can't see over the ridge to where the cup is. You can see the flag, but you can't see the cup. And so I hit this shot and the ball disappeared over the ridge. And I'm just thinking, wow, good shot. Maybe I got to tap in birdie. And we go up to the green, myself, Anthony Sr., Anthony Jr., and Anthony Jr. says, and he runs up to the hole first. I don't see it. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to be on the green. You got to be kidding me. So, you know, I'm thinking, how did my ball roll off to this big old green? And he runs up and looks in the cup and he says, it's in the hole. So, yes, two hole-in-ones.
I love it.
And as a result, I thought, you know, you should just buy lotto tickets, Mega Millions, man, because if you got two hole-in-ones, you got to be able to hit this thing. And that has not worked out.
Okay.
I stopped wasting my money on the tickets.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, they have it on your phone now, so it's even easier to spend and lose your money. So there's an app for that now.
Yes, but yes, two hole-in-ones, thankfully. And, you know, if I don't get another one, I'm okay.
Okay, so we're gonna wrap it up here. But for the people listening, if you had to leave them with some last words of wisdom regarding jewelry, their jewelry process, or even just this wild and crazy place we call entrepreneurship, when no one understands it and no one gets why you're doing that crazy thing, what would you leave them with?
Well, the entrepreneurial spirit is alive and well in our culture, and I support it. However I can. As far as jewelry is concerned, if you're looking for fine jewelry and you want to spend money within your own culture, I would love to be part of that journey. As far as the golf is concerned, I think the best thing we can do as far as adults, or I just turned 60, so I'm officially an adult now, but we need to pass on what we've learned to younger people. And I work now with high school, middle school, and elementary school principals to bring golf into the schools. So this year, I have two middle schools. These kids blow me away with their talent. They blow me away with their discipline. All they really need to be is taught. And next year, I'm going to have those two middle schools, and I'm adding two elementary schools. So if I have to start with plastic clubs and plastic balls so that these kids don't hit each other in the head and they understand the fundamentals of the game before they get a real club and a real ball in their hand, I will do that. But all of us as entrepreneurs, whatever industry you're in, whatever talent you have, find somebody younger than you, A, to learn from, and B, to teach.
There it is. There you have it. Well, thank you, Frank, for joining us on this episode of Tease Me.
Latoya, you're awesome. Thank you.
A very special shout out to Frank for sharing those gems with us. And he's right. You have to pass on the information to the next generation. It's Father's Day, and a lot of kids don't necessarily have father figures that can give them the information that they need. So be that resource to a young man that needs the support or a young woman that needs the support. Be the person and give the information that you have that you needed. As we celebrate Juneteenth, it's another scenario where we've told stories and the stories get passed forward. Now, the commercialization of Juneteenth and the person that's deciding that this is a holiday and yada, 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 I'd rather see a bank party than a block party, but that's my opinion. So as we celebrate, don't forget to compensate and think about communicate and also cultivate the next generation of entrepreneurs, of leaders, of doers. Tell them your stories. They need to hear them. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Tease Me.